Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, come to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening, good evening, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to the third episode of Criminalized by Color. And as I've said before, we're not white bashing. We are system bashing. And we're not just talking about problems. We really want to move from talking about problems to exploring what some solutions are. Now, if you tuned in last week, as my guest, I have Professor Jamal Ture with me, and we focused on criminalizing children. And we're going to take it a little bit further from that perspective as we continue with our conversation today. Now, what I thought I'd do as we begin tonight's session is to add a segment to our conversation. I'm going to start off with kind of taking a temperature check, if you will, by taking a look at the big picture. So I'm going to ask the question that Marvin Gaye asked many, many years ago. What's going on? Right? When we look at our world today, when we look at things that are happening in the United States, what's going on? Now, currently, many people are fixated with the trial of the men who killed Ahmaud Arbery, and we know that the jury selection has been completed. Now, here's what's interesting about that. The judge says it looks like discrimination could be going on. The prosecution is saying that the defense deliberately ruled out or disqualified black jurors. Even though the judge agreed with them, he's allowing the trial to proceed with just one black juror. What's going on? Now, it used to be, because I teach black history, so I know it used to be, that when blacks were put on trial, they were tried by an all-white jury, and that was okay. And it took a lot of legislation, a lot of protest, a lot of people working together to challenge that that way of doing things and to call for more diverse juries. As a matter of fact, that still remains an ongoing struggle, even in contemporary times. Now, in this case, we have white men who killed a black man, and they're being tried by almost an all-white jury, and that's okay. I don't know about you, but I see something wrong with that. I agree with the judge. Something discriminatory about that. However, the judge really did have the latitude and the power to make another decision and, you know, make them do something different, but instead he decided to allow the trial to proceed. So I encourage all of us to pay close attention to where this goes. What else is going on? Most states, most jurisdictions just recently held local elections. And actually, this was the local elections around the country resulted in huge victories for many people of color. So there's a woman named Winsome Sears. She's a black female. She won Virginia's lieutenant governor on the Republic ticket. An Asian woman by the name of Michelle Wu was the first woman and the first Asian elected to be mayor of Boston. Yay, Michelle. A black male by the name of Eric, he was elected to be the mayor of New York City on a Republican ticket. Alvin Bragg was the first black to lead Manhattan's district attorney's office on a Democratic ticket. A guy named Ed Gainey was the first male voted, black male voted as mayor of Pittsburgh, and he was on a Democratic ticket. Jason Mayers is the first Cuban-American attorney general in Virginia, and he was on a Republican ticket. Aftab Perlreval, he's the first Asian mayor of Cincinnati. He was on a Democratic ticket. And Abdullah Hamad, the first Arab American elected mayor in a city with a concentrated Arab population, and that being Dearborn, Michigan. So we see historically some things are changing, and that's good. That's a good thing. Whether they were Democratic or Republican, it's good that black people are making some inroads. It's good that people of color are making some inroads in terms of local politics. A lot of times we have our sight on the presidential politics, and of course many people were very excited about Barack Obama, but we can't get fixated on national when so many things are going on locally. So that's the big picture. That's what's going on, and I invite you to send me a text or email. You can email me at criminalizedbycolor@gmail.com. You can go to the website, www.maxinebryant.com or www.drmaxinebryant.com. You can leave comments. But anyway, let me know. Hit me up on Facebook, on Messenger, if you have any other suggestions that we can take a look at the beginning of the show when we take a look at the big picture and ask, what's going on? So our focus today is, like I said earlier, I want to start where Professor Teray and I left off, when we talked about criminalizing our children. And I want to take a look at the impact of institutionalized racism on the family, particularly looking at the children. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with a woman by the name of Joy DeGry. She's a professor, a very talented sociologist, and she wrote a book called The Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. The post-traumatic slave syndrome. And she talks about generational history, genetic history of slavery and the impact on the family. I'm not going to talk about that right now, but I want to start off this evening's conversation with a story that Dr. DeGry tells at the beginning of her book. She tells the story of the Kasserian and Jinra warriors in a tribe in Africa. Now, these were warriors. These were people, men, who were responsible for keeping the village safe. They were warriors. They were fighters. And as these warriors would meet each other, I'm sorry, they were not the Kasserian and Jinra warriors. That's what they said to each other. But when they would meet each other, they would greet one another with the words Kasserian and Jinra. And what that means is, and how are the children? Now, the expected response from the other person, the other warrior, was, all the children are well. That meant that peace and safety prevailed, that the priorities of protecting the young and the powerless were in place. That meant that the community had not forgotten its reason for being, that being creating a safe haven for all of the occupants. Those words, all the children are well, meant that all is good. And the daily struggles of existing even among the poor people, did not preclude the village from engaging in properly caring for its young. I mean, the village, the people, the adults, were taking good care of the children of the village. All was well, all was stable, all was peaceful. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to inform you tonight something that you already know. Our children are not well. Probably many of the children in the United States, but particularly children of color, are not well. They're traumatized by community violence. Every time a gunshot goes off, every time a peer dies, every time they see a fight, every time there's violence in the home, every time they witness black-on-black crime, every time they see death by arrest, every time they're discriminated in school, every time a parent is incarcerated and leaves a child behind, they're traumatized. Now, a lot has been written about the impact of incarceration as it relates to children of incarcerated parents. For example, over 24 million people, children, in the United States live without their biological father. That's 33%. Of the students in grades 1 through 12, a whopping 39%, that's over 17 million children, live in homes who are in grades 1 through 12, who live in homes where their biological father is absent. Listen to this. 57.6% of black children, 31.2% of Hispanic children, and 20% of white children live in households where their fathers are absent. Now, remember the first week we got together and I told you about the black codes and how the black codes were designed to arrest for minor charges black people, namely the men, so that gave them a way to get free labor. They would put them in chain gangs. They had free labor as a result of the black codes. And how that pattern into the 25th century, we're witnessing what I'm calling the 21st century black codes, where now not only are they arresting black men at a higher rate for misdemeanors, they're now also killing them. And many of those killed were fathers. They had children. Regardless of how active they were in their child's lives, they had children. And the men I'm getting ready to suggest to you actually were active in their children's lives. Fernando Castile was a father. Eric Garner had children ranging in 18 to 24. George Floyd had a daughter. Alton Stewart Sterling had a son. John Crawford, the guy shot dead in a Walmart in Ohio, had three children. Walter Scott, children. Each of these black men who experienced death by arrest for a misdemeanor, which is what I'm calling the 21st century black code, was a father. They had sired children. They had some kind of relationship, and that's just a few of the people that I found in my research as I was preparing for our conversation tonight. The other thing that I thought about when I thought about the well-being of the children in the village was my experience as a welfare caseworker. Now, right out of college, my first job was a welfare caseworker. So that was in the 80s. So if you do the math, you can kind of figure out how old I am. But anyway, I was in the 80s, and my job as a welfare caseworker was to go into the homes. I lived in Indiana, and we still made home visits at that time. And my responsibility was to make sure there was not a man in the household. Now, if I saw evidence of a man in the household, if I saw male shoes, if I looked in the closet, and we were supposed to look in the closet, and I saw male clothing, or if I even saw male cologne on the dresser, I was supposed to report that woman and her AFDC was going to be terminated. That's what it was called back then, aid to families with dependent children. And the irony is that it was called aid to families. But yet, it was built on a system of breaking up the family. It was built on a system that encouraged, as a matter of fact, demanded that mother to live in a household without the father, or her benefits would be stopped. So it encouraged single parenting. Now, the idea of children being separated from their parents is not new, right? Particularly being separated from the father, but the mother too. It's been happening since the times of enslaving captured Africans. And did you know that most of the Africans that were captured during the slave trade were in their teens and in their 20s? They were ripe for work. They were ripe for childbearing. They were young babies, right? And the slave catchers went after them, separating them at that moment from their mothers and their fathers and from the safety of the village. In the United States South, in the decades prior to the Civil War, half of all enslaved blacks were under the age of 16. Half of them were under, they were babies. And you know from slave trading and from slave sales, many of them were separated from their parents. About half of all the United States enslaved children grew up apart from their father, either because he lived on another plantation and had been sold away, or because he was white. Now, you all know the comedian Trevor Noah. He even wrote a book. Now, he was from Africa, and he wrote a book that was called Born a Crime. Now, where did that come from? Well, Trevor's father was white. His mother was black. And at that time, in Africa, in the part of Africa where he lives, I think it was South Africa, it was a crime for a white man and a black woman to join together. But his parents did. And they were able to kind of co-parent, but his father could not live with them, in spite of the fact that his father and his mother kind of really loved each other, right? He was born a criminal. He was born a crime because his very existence broke the law. You ought to get that book. It's amusing, and Trevor tells it in his amusing kind of story-like format, and it's really engaging and entertaining, yet it's painful at times because it tells the story of a young boy, continual presence from his dad. Now, while that's traumatic, and we learned in our first session that people respond to trauma differently. Some people push past the trauma and the pain, and they're able to become your doctors and your lawyers and get educated. They're the grads. And then there are some people who get caught up in the pain of trauma and are unable to push past it, and they become what we call the bads, the people who often end up behind bars. And then you have your people who then suffer from depression, and they are your sads, right? Frederick Douglass made an interesting observation when he looked at the impact of children who were separated from their parents during slavery time. He said, and I quote, he believed that slave owners purposely separated children from their parents in order to blunt the development of the affection between them. So it was deliberate. The separation of children from their mothers, children from their fathers, was deliberate so that the bond of family would be broken. Do we still see that happening today? I read recently of a story, true story, of a young enslaved boy. Now, he was out playing, just had a moment of downtime, And his father called to him at the very same time that his master's wife called for him. So you have dad saying, hey, come here. You have the master's wife saying, hey, come here. And he hesitated, right? He had to ask himself, who had the strongest claim on his obedience? Should he obey his father at the risk of the wrath of his master and his master's wife? Or should he go to his master's wife at the risk of angering his father? What do you think he chose? If you said he chose to go to his master's wife, you're correct. Wow. What had he learned? That it was better to go to the white master's wife than to obey his black father? Seriously? What lesson were being taught? Wow. The opening scene of the butler, you may remember that. And it was where the young boy and everybody on the plantation, it was actually post-plantation, they were sharecropping. But everyone on the field saw the white man come and take the little black boy's mother and go into the house, and everybody knew what they were doing. And the little boy looked at his dad and said, hey, wait, daddy, why ain't you doing something? You know what he's doing to mama. Why ain't you doing something? You need to be the protector. You need to protect us. You need to protect mom. And the dad kind of got some courage about him, and he said, I'm going to say something. So the next time overseer came and was getting ready to take his wife, he said something. He stepped to him. Do you remember what happened? The overseer shot the father dead right in front of that boy. What did the boy learn? What messages are we teaching the children? Not we, but it's the system. This broken system that we live in, what is it teaching the children? I understand we have some callers on the line. I got one more story I want to share, and then we'll come to you. I mentioned Joy DeGry at the opening of today's session, today's segment, today's episode. And she tells a story. Now, remember, she's talking about the genetic memory that is passed down from generation to generation. So she talks about a child who was being good, actually. And a white mother brags on her child and the good that he's being. And the mother was like, oh, no, you know, he's okay. He's not that bright. He's not that good. But where did that come from? George DeGry points back to slavery. And she points back to the mother who's working alongside her daughter. And the white slave owner comes and he says, yeah, you got a pretty little thing right there. She looks like she's working pretty hard. Well, the mother doesn't want her daughter to be sold, and the mother doesn't want her daughter to become a sex slave. So her mother then begins to belittle the daughter so she wouldn't be so appealing to the white master. Oh, let's say it's a mother and she's working alongside her adolescent son. And the overseer comes and says, hey, you got a strong young man there. Yeah, I think he'd be good. And the mother doesn't want to see her son sold. So she belittles the little boy. Now, the little girl and the little boy, they don't understand that the mother's trying to protect them from being misused or from being abused. And probably by the time they figure it out, they have children of their own, and they've learned that. George DeGry says 400 years later, many black parents, particularly those 50 years and older, are not bragging on a child, right? Even though they're proud of that child. Why? Could it be because they have learned an appropriate adaptation of how to act in a hostile situation. And they don't want bad things to happen to the child as a result of them bragging. And many of our younger parents, that's not their issue at all. But Joy DeGry says, particularly for those who are older, that may play into how they interact and how they are still trying to protect their children, sometimes even from themselves, from getting the big head, right? Joy DeGry says, even now in the 21st century, we're still suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. Now I'm going to come back to that after this break. We're going to break and have our first commercial. And for those of you who are on the line, after the commercial, we're going to call the last four digits of your number. If you don't have anything to say, you don't have a question, you don't have a comment, then don't say anything and we'll just go on to the next caller. However, if you do have a question or a comment, that will be your time to ask away, to comment away. So let's take a pause for the cause and listen to this commercial.
Motivational, educational, informative, inspirational, relevant, knowledgeable, nationally, internationally. These are the words seminar participants have used to describe this dynamic presenter. Topics as non-threatening as customer service. Topics as delicate as race relations, diversity, and inclusion. Dr. Maxine Bryan has repeatedly captured the hearts and minds of many audiences. Dr. Bryan's expertise has assisted private industry and nonprofit businesses as they move forward to realize their desired goals. Call Pat Maltz at 612-876-7964. Book Dr. Bryant. Take your workforce to the next level.
All right. So, thank you very much for tuning in again. You're listening to Criminalized by Color, and I am Dr. Maxine Bryant. So I understand we do have some callers on the line. If you have a question or you want to make a comment, feel free to do so after I call the last four digits of your phone number. And if you're calling in to listen to the show and you do not have a question or a comment, just remain silent and I'll go on to the next number. So caller, 5258, do you have a question or a comment?
No.
Last four. Hello? Last four digits, 5258. You have a question or comment? Thank you for listening. We'll go on to 7191. 7191. Do you have a question or a comment? Okay, I want to thank you for listening also. How about 0787? Do you have a question or a comment?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And we have a private number, someone who's calling from a private number. Do you have a question or a comment? Awesome. I do want to thank those of you who are calling in to listen to the show, as well as those who clicked on the link and are listening. So thank you very much for your support. Thank you very much for tuning in. So we'll continue. If you will recall, a moment ago, right before our commercial break, I was talking about those genetic memories that Joy DeGry says is happening in the minds of Black people in particular that have been passed on genetically from slavery and what that does to particularly our parenting styles. More so for people like 50 years and older, she believes that pertains to, she didn't say that, but as I was reading her material, I think it's more applicable to older parents. So when I first came to Savannah, my second year teaching at what was then Armstrong University, I was teaching Intro to African American Studies. And I teach from a very Afrocentric perspective. I was teaching my students who were largely black that they came from kings and queens and that the Egyptians were the first people to sail and the first people to come up with medical ways. I taught them that in West Africa, we still had the first of many things. I taught them that creation began in Africa. I was trying to build them up, help them to feel good about themselves, because I believe that if we know our accurate history, it can begin to change how we view ourselves. I can like myself better if I know that I am the descendant of the best of the best of the best. Right? And if I can love myself better, then I can love those who look like me better. The other thing that kind of teaching does is that it challenges the status quo. Now, keep in mind, I said the majority of my students were black. And, of course, they would go home because many of them had never heard black history taught that way or African-American history taught from an asset base, from a positive base. And they went home and they were telling their parents what Dr. Bryan had shared with them. Tell you parents were upset with me. Oh, my goodness. I had one parent to tell her daughter that I was the devil. Like, are you serious? What? And at first, I was perplexed. I was flabbergasted. I'm like, what is going on? Really, like, really, what's going on? And I didn't know how to respond. I mean, part of me was angry. Like, you know, here I am teaching your children from an asset-based black perspective, you calling me the devil, what's up with that? And then I took a step back because I had to realize I was in the deep South. I'm in Georgia, right? I'm in the deep South. And that was like in 2015. And we were just 50 years from the Jim Crow and civil rights era. You know, the Civil Rights Act of 1965 had just been passed 50 years prior. And what I thought about was the fact that those parents and those grandparents were afraid. They were afraid that if their children were too empowered and they bucked the system too much, that danger would come to them. You see, they lived in a time when if you bucked the system, you could get lynched. If you bucked the system, you could get whipped. Bad things would happen to you if you spoke out against the injustices. You could be jailed if you spoke out against the injustice. If you carried your black pride too much, things could happen to you, such as the Black Panthers with the I'm black and I'm proud, you know, or, you know, with black power. And so they were trying, just like Joy DeGrasse said, to protect their children. Then I began to think about that thing more and more and deeper and deeper. And I thought about in the age of slavery, during the era of slavery, little black children were learning some things, and little white children were learning some things, and they were not learning exactly the same thing from the same perspective. Little black children were learning that they were property, that they were less than, and they could be sold away from their parents any moment. They were learning that they were inferior. Little white children were learning that they were superior, that their fathers and mothers owned the black people. What do you think little black children taught their children? And they may have been telling them in the praise houses and in private conversations that, you know, you are something. You know, the sky is the limit for you. That may have been what they were whispering in their ear. But they also told them, you got to, you know, we slaves, and we got to obey the master. And we are in an inferior position right now. That they may not have used that terminology, but basically that's what they were saying. We are inferior. And little white children were teaching their children when they grew up that they were superior. And so with each generation, there was a lesson learned. White people learned they were superior, and the laws were on their side. It perpetuated that myth. Black children were learning that they were inferior. Now, keep in mind, I am generalizing, but impact, that those messages that were handed down from generation to generation had on the children, and the children's children, and the children's children's children. So, when I thought about that, I thought also of the 250-some-odd years of enslavement in the United States. And the first generation, which was about 50 people, remembered Africa, and they longed to return to Africa, and they told stories of Africa, and they were able to tell their children of the kings and queens and the greatness of Africa. Second generation, that next 50 years, remember the stories that were told by their parents. Now, that third generation now, three generations removed, they only heard of the secondhand stories of Africa, and all they knew was slavery. And the fourth generation, Africa was a very distant place, and they had been fully indoctrinated into colonial America way of thinking, that blacks were less than. They weren't even a whole human being. I don't know if you remember the movie Roots. I think it was the second time the movie Roots came out. And Kuta, who was fresh from Africa, was trying to get Fiddler to understand, hey, we got to get away. We don't belong here. Remember Kuta said, we don't belong in chains. Fiddler, it ain't right. It ain't right. We got to get away. We got to go get freedom. Fiddler said, I don't understand this thing you call freedom. Has always been a slave. I don't know nothing about this freedom. Wow. How sad is that? And then the fifth generation had been totally indoctrinated into inferiority. They may have yearned for freedom, and they knew that something was not right. Inferiority had been deeply seated in many of them. That's why Harriet Tubman had such a hard time convincing many folks to come on, let's leave here. Just yesterday in class, in my class, it was Tuesday, I had a student who wrote a paper on newspaper articles, and she wrote from Statesboro. She lived in Statesboro. We have three campuses, one in Savannah, one in Statesboro, which is an hour away, and one in Hinesville, Georgia. And she's on the Statesboro campus. And she did a little bit of research. She wanted to find out if there was any black newspapers in Statesboro that came out of a discussion that I led. And she found out, no, there were no black newspapers. So she then began on her own to research what the white newspapers had to say about black people. When I tell you that her paper brought tears to my eyes, it really, really did. In the not-too-distant past in Statesboro, they celebrated lynching. They celebrated little black boys being beaten for menial things that they may have done. They advocated for the mistreatment of black people in media. I think what brought that on was that I shared a poem by a woman by the name of Estelle Popple, and she takes the Pledge of Allegiance and she juxtaposes it against a lynching that she had seen the night before. I may have to share that with you all. It was powerful. It was absolutely a powerful moment. I had the class to read the Pledge of Allegiance, and then I read the words that Esther wrote, and it was like we're living in a farce, right? You know, and we really have to watch the message that our systems are giving our children. Even in the not-too-distant past, a couple of weeks ago, children on a campus in Savannah witnessed a black man being totally dehumanized, totally humiliated by a white woman in front of a group of students. Why? Are we still doing that in this day and age? Really? So here's the question. So what? Now what? So what? We're having this conversation about criminalizing children. Now what? What are some things that we can do about it? How much power do we have as citizens of the United States? One thing we can do is advocate for accurate history to be taught in our schools. Why? Because knowledge is power. Knowledge empowers, but it's got to be accurate knowledge. Far too long in our school system, we learned that Africa was a wilderness full of heathens and people who were like Tarzans, and they couldn't read or write and didn't have a language, didn't have a religion or anything. No, that's not true, right? As a matter of fact, Christianity was born out of Africa. Think about this. In the book of Acts, one of the Roman soldiers looks at Paul and he says, "Aren't you one of the Egyptians?" Egyptian? Well, contrary to common belief, what's that girl's name, the Taylor person, Elizabeth Taylor, who played Cleopatra? That ain't how Cleopatra looked. Cleopatra had locks, right? So the Egyptians were dark-skinned people with what we would call nappy hair, kinky hair, locks, right? And I may talk more about that. I may have a black historian, an Afrocentric historian, a theologian to talk with us on one of these shows. I may do that. But at any rate, we can advocate for accurate history to be taught in our schools so that everybody knows the truth, not just black people, but white people. Because remember, they've been giving misinformation too. And it's time to turn that around. And we who are parents and grandparents and concerned citizens and advocates for justice, we can advocate for that. They call it critical race theory, and they want to belittle it. But it's to be owned. It's to be taught accurately. It's nothing but accurate history. Makes you wonder what the systems are so afraid of, right? Another thing that we can do as voters in our various jurisdictions, we can advocate for laws to be changed that foster separation of children from their parents, right? As it relates to the criminal justice system, one of the things that we can do is recommend the ending of cash bail. Now, and we've done that in Savannah. I'm a part of a task force that put that recommendation out. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Well, let's say a parent, let's say a father, is arrested for something and he lives through the arrest, right? And he has the opportunity to put up bail. Well, if he puts up bail, then he can go home and he can be with his children, his family, and continue working until a court date has been decided. If he can't put up bail, then he remains in jail. I received a text today. A friend of mine wants to advocate and help a person who's in a local jail, not Savannah, but one not too far from him, who has been in jail 4 years waiting for his case to go to court. Seriously, 4 years? Do you know that you're only supposed to be held in jail for no period more than a year? Like, and that's after you've been convicted of a misdemeanor. He's been in there 4 years. So he's been separated from his family. I do not know if there are children involved, but definitely separated from the children. Right? That whole thing about cash bail needs to be eradicated. I'm not, you know, too much into, like, pop culture and contemporary music and stuff. I listen to some of it. But Beyonce's husband did a documentary on a young man in New York. His name is Khalif Browder. Now, Khalif was 13 and got arrested for a stolen backpack. Now, the truth of the matter is he didn't even steal a backpack, but he got arrested for it. His bail was only $300, but his mom couldn't, she didn't have $300. So Khalif was put in jail. He's put in Rikers of all places. This happened in New York. Khalif spent 3 years in Rikers, a kid, for a crime he didn't commit. Experienced immense trauma, experienced beatings and rapes and beatings from the guards as well as from other people who were incarcerated. He didn't know where the next blow was coming from, he says in a documentary. Eventually, after 3 years, he was released because they didn't have enough evidence to convict him. He was released, right? The trauma of having spent that much time in a jail setting as an adolescent, as a young boy, he killed himself within a year or two of being released. So what can we do? We can advocate for ending cash bail. We can advocate for ending the practice of incarcerating the absent parent for non-payment. It does not make any sense to you. You're away from the parent, from the children anyway, so you have a child support order. But you're working, right? You're working. Maybe you have an arrearage. And you get behind, and what we do is we incarcerate you. Duh. Can you still work? Like, no, right? In that practice. For those of us who, for trauma-informed care, we need to do that. I was in a meeting this past Monday, and we were talking about the ills of society. It was with law enforcement and service providers. And when it came to my turn to speak, I spoke out that our communities are traumatized. Our children are traumatized. Our families are traumatized. And we need to begin to address that before we can talk about healing, before we can talk about reducing the recidivism rate, which is the rate at which people return back to crime, right? We can learn about that. So I went to the website. I went to several websites to identify other things that can be done in order to break the cycle of criminalizing our children. One of the things that came up is that if the parents are living together, whether they're married or not, suspend the enforcement of a child support order. I mean, they're like living together. They're taking care of the family. They're working this thing out. Right, so why don't we leave them alone instead of just locking up people for non-payment of child support? Since I'm going down that rabbit, ensure that the guidelines allow for the parent who needs to support the children to meet their basic needs after paying support instead of taking all the money for support, right? Because they'd be more likely to become a partner in this with the mother and with the government. Also, there's training opportunities and job search opportunities that we can meet out to help that absentee father. The biggest thing, particularly as it relates to children of incarcerated parents, is to think of other ways, come up with other ways that we can deal with them, address them, their needs, their struggles to incarcerating them, whether that's mental health assistance, drug abuse programs, parenting. Here in Savannah, we do have an organization called Parent University, which kind of fits in that mold of teaching some parenting skills so that people are less likely to mistreat their children, maltreat their children, or to get it wrong, so to speak. So it's there to teach some parenting skills. Another thing that agencies can do, and we can advocate for our legislators to empower these agencies primarily through funding, to ensure that child support agencies and other agencies develop partnerships with court systems and social service agencies so that we're working together for the betterment of our children and not working apart, not competing or conflicting. That's the word I really want. We're not conflicting them, but we're working together that the family feels supported as opposed to being ripped apart by the system. So I'm going to pause here. I understand that we do have another caller. I think before we take that caller, do we have another commercial coming up? I think that we can break here and we can hear another commercial, and then I'll go to the caller that's on the line and see if that caller has a question or a comment. Let's break for a commercial.
Have you been frozen in fear, stuck on stupid, lost in love, tormented with troubling relationships, felt disconnected, discombobulated, and dismissed? Has parenting ever felt more like a burden than a blessing? Have you questioned your own sanity, doubted your own self-worth, wished you were someone else somewhere else? Do you ever feel you're not good enough, not pretty enough, not smart enough, not talented enough, unworthy, unlovable, undeserving? Then you know what it feels like to be out of your groove. The Groove Doctor has just the right prescription. Get your copy of Dr. Maxine Vine's book, I Want My Groove Back God's Way. Begin your journey today living in real groove. Dr. Maxine Brown uses her own experiences and spiritual insights to guide the reader to a place of real groove by helping readers attain a holistic state of groove based on Bible principles. Go to www.mygrooveback.com to order your copy today. $10 plus shipping costs. You will be glad you did.
So what I will say is that I truly believe that God created all of us to live in his groove, and that includes us as individuals as well as the family. And when systems such as the economic system, the court system, the educational system, even our system, our government system, all of these systems, when they work in almost concert to the disabling of families, particularly black families, then it's going to be up to us to save us. We can no longer expect government just to say, okay, my bad, we got it wrong. You know, that's probably not going to happen. So we have to be able to be empowered to act. There's a difference. I'm going to say this and I'm going to go to the caller. I want you to think about this. There's a difference between having a renter mentality and a homeowner mentality. If I have a renter mentality, then my mentality is that my landlord's going to fix it. I don't have to. My landlord's going to fix it. When I have a homeowner mentality, I realize that the buck stops with me. I got to fix it, right? I made that analogy Monday, and I told the people I've learned how to be a good plumber these days, right? So it is with expecting government to step in and fix our issues. We have to advocate for that. We can no longer rest with a renter mentality when it comes to changing things in our community. We have to take ownership of the issues and the challenges and the solutions. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. Let me go to the caller that's on the line, 4600. If those are the last four digits of your number, can you please make a comment or a question if you have one?
I got a comment and a question. One, you may mention that Cash Bell and you in Savannah, Georgia. Well, that's good for the people in Savannah, Georgia, but where I am here up north of you in the Midwest, I think we need to keep our Cash Bell. And I think that's where, I think that's where some of the problem comes, that people in their community think that what they want to make a change for their community needs to be projected all over the country. And really, the federal government doesn't have any say-so over cash bails. That's a community thing. Yeah, so I think we come to agreement on that. Now, you talk about the history. In your school district,
oh, but wait
you can
wait,
teach
wait, before you go to history, before you go mm-hmm. to the history, let me ask you about, I want to ask you two things. One, I'd like to know your rationale. I'm really curious about the benefits of cash bail that you see. And can you tell us your first name?
Well, my first name is Pianchi. The benefits okay. of cash bail is the same as it is when you get a traffic ticket. They take your driver's license as bail, and people don't even show up for that, and they haven't issued out any cash whatsoever. So it's all about making people assured that they're going to appear in court, because, you know, not appearing in court includes a cost that the municipality has to pay on. And when you have a number of those, it becomes a burden.
So let me ask you this. For those people who end up spending an extraordinary amount of time in jail because they don't have bail money, what's another alternative?
Well, where are their friends?
Well, maybe
where
they don't
the family?
Have them.
Well,
maybe
then,
they don't have them.
I don't know what to tell you. You know, like, for instance, like Sandra Bland. Sandra Bland, mm-hmm. her bail was $500. You mean you tell me your mm-hmm. family couldn't come up with $500 to bail you out?
Some people say really can't.
Guess what? Rosa Parks' house in Detroit was about to be tore down. It was condemned. And uh-huh. the amount that needed to be paid to keep it from being condemned and tore down was $500.
Okay.
Detroit have over 600,000 black people. You mean to uh-huh. tell me that she didn't mean enough that you can come together and do $500 to save that house? It took a black, it took a white man from Germany. Yeah,
yeah,
white man from Germany saved that house and took it back to Germany. He had it disassembled.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing, mm-hmm. on critical race, like we're saying, you can teach your children in your district whatever you want, not like mm-hmm. the candidate for governor in Virginia that said that parents have no business, the Democratic candidate, have no business telling school districts what to teach their children.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to teach your children whatever, that's up to you. That's your school district. But what you mm-hmm. have is you have some voices want to teach white people's children, and they don't want it. And guess what? Some blacks don't want it either. And I know Asians don't. But let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1970s, early 70s, they had another critical race theory. It was called a Latina critical race theory.
Okay.
And theirs was strictly about the history themselves. They didn't try to push it on the blacks. They didn't try to push it on the whites. It was for their own children in the areas where they existed.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good one.
Okay. So I don't know how old you were, but when you were in school, what kind of history did – let me see how I can ask this question. Did you learn accurate African-American history, or was it taught from a white perspective?
No, I learned history that was taught from an American perspective.
Okay.
We didn't learn any African history. We didn't learn history on the African continent because we weren't African. We are American citizens.
No, but that I didn't say African. I said African American. And here's
well, we learned the history.
We only got 1 minute. We only got. One
we learned
minute.
The history. We learned the history at the time. Yeah. Now we didn't learn about Barack Obama because there was no Barack Obama then.
No, I'm not talking about Barack. All I'm saying is that history, accurate history, benefits both white children and black children. But far too long in our educational system, the history that has
well,
been
let me ask
taught
you a quick question.
Has been from a white perspective.
What can you tell me about the Tuskegee experiment?
I can tell you that it was about withholding the shot or the medicine
to black men, right?
For syphilis. Right, it was for
okay,
black
now let me ask you
it
something.
Was against black
in your history, did they tell you about the white male that was forcefully injected with malaria?
I
you
do
ever
know
heard
about
that?
That. I have.
Yeah, but it's never taught. See, we want to tell whites about what happened to blacks, want to tell whites what happened to them about what somebody white done who have no relationship to the ones that's here today, but the other side nobody wants to mention.
No, I would beg to differ.
I'm not saying you. I'm saying typically it's like that.
Okay. But what I'm saying in general is that it benefits all of us to learn accurate whole history and not have it be whitened or not have critical parts be left out for the comfort of a few. But you know,
and nor should it be black, neither, ma'am. Believe me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that call. I am so sorry.
Before you hang up.
Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the producer, Dr. Maxine, and I was trying to interject before your caller hung up.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Do you mind if I say something? I know you're in overtime.
I am in overtime, but, you know, you're the producer.
Well, you know, you can take all the time you want, but you did let him know about the time factor. I just wanted to come in and interject because I have studied a little bit of history, and you're going to get different perspectives depending on a person's socialization. The gentleman said he was from the North. And I could tell where your line of questioning was going as to, you know, well, what was he taught? How was he taught? And there's a difference between Northern socialization and Southern socialization when it comes to Black history, period. And you're going to have those that are, what are they? I forget the term that they call them, but when they lean towards the oppressor, you're going to have those that lean towards the oppressor. If not, Harriet Tubman would have never had to carry a shotgun, just like you said before. Harriet Tubman had to carry a shotgun more so for her own people than for the enslaved catcher that she was running from. You see, because the socialization of our people is to stay behind the bars and the conditions that disable and prevent us from prospering and pushing forward. But I want to thank you for your subject and your show, and I just really wanted to catch that gentleman to spark his mindset and his thinking when it comes to how overbearing it seemed he was a little leaning more northern, and it's socialization. We don't blame anyone. It's a matter of what you're conditioned with. So thank you so much for an enlightening show, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. You used that word socialization, and that's a good word, but that's actually what I've been talking about in terms of the messages that our generations have been given. So that's exactly what it was. It's being socialized to think a certain way. So thank you. I want to thank each and every one of my listeners. Have a little bit more, but we're going to go in and cut it off. This has been a very enlightening and informative and hopefully motivational, because I really want you to ask the question, so what, now what? Now what do we do with this information? If information and knowledge is power, what do I do now that I have been empowered? Thank you very much. This is Dr. Maxine Glion, and you have been listening to Criminalized by Color.
Dr. Maxine will be on November 18th for her fourth episode of Flies by Color.
That is true.
MaxineBryant.com.
Thank you very much, producer. Yes, please join in on the next edition of Criminalized by Color, and that will be November the 18th, I think. Is that what you said?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Same place, same time. Thank you very much.
Can't wait. Good night.
Good night.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won.
the heavens. No man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, no. The
glory, glory.
Oh.
Every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win the war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,